Well, it is weird science, at least how it looks at us from where we sit now. In fact, the weirder the better. Sometimes it's out of that weird fringe that we find survival, both for, say, victims of these improvised weapons in Iraq or Afghanistan, soldiers who have lost limbs, only to get them back. And not just ones that are functional in the traditional hook, but the cutting edge, cool new prosthetic devices we'll tell you about from the Department of Mad Science, how DARPA is remaking our world, and how the from the internet to artificial limbs. You'll hear much more about the true nature of the internet, the origins of it, as well as some of the visions that are coming out of these DARPA-funded projects right now, which are being revealed for the very first time by our guest, Michael Belfiore, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Amongst other places, Michael Belfiore is a writer for Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, and he writes popular books like Rocketeers and this new book, The Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World, and How the Internet, From the Internet to Artificial Limbs. Michael Belfiore, congratulations on getting this very unusual, very private look at what they're doing at DARPA.
Well, thank you.
And we say DARPA, we should define our terms up front for people that know. There's a difference between ARPA and DARPA, and that just because there's a DARPA, it doesn't mean that there's one central place where all of these experiments are taking place. It's actually spread out all over the country.
Yeah, naturally, ARPA and DARPA are the same agency. It stands for the Advanced Research Projects Agency, and then they added the D in the early 70s for Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. But it's still the same agency. It's been from its inception part of the U.S. Department of Defense, and it's true they don't have their own laboratories, so they farm out the work to researchers all over the country, in some cases around the world.
How many DARPA-funded projects are going on right now?
I don't actually know because half of what they do is top secret.
Right.
So I've seen the top half of the iceberg and just a hint of below the surface. And new projects are coming online all the time, and old ones are dropping off. In fact, even DARPA itself doesn't know how many projects they have funded in the past. They don't keep good records. They're always looking forward. And there's a 25% turnover rate among the staff there whose job is to dream up crazy ideas.
Well, and that's what do we say, the staff there? Again, I want to be clear about this because it sounds like a lot of the DARPA research army is fairly virtual. I mean, they come and they go, they do a project, then they go and they get their funding from somebody else for the next project. But then there's a core of people who stay funded by DARPA for maybe their entire careers.
Yeah, there's a range of so here are the layers. You've got the DARPA organization itself within the Department of Defense. They started out in the Pentagon. Now they're in an unmarked office building in Arlington, Virginia.
That's so cool.
And most of them are not military personnel. Only about 10% of them are, and they're recruited from universities, private companies, and one at least one case I know of. My editor at Wired.com was recruited, or they tried to recruit him. The guy who runs the danger room over there, Noah Shachtman, but he refused. But these
What about it didn't appeal to him to work for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency? What about that was?
I'm sure it was flattering. He just didn't feel he was qualified, and that, so that's the thing. What is the qualification for being a DARPA program
Yeah.
manager? And these are the folks who come up with the ideas. You know, this top layer of these layers I'm talking about.
I think you got to be kind of like twisted enough to come up with stuff that other people dare not speak of.
So Tony Tether, the head of DARPA, while I was writing this book, told me, I asked him, what are the qualifications? He said, you have to be a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
That's what he said. So these guys sit in a room, well, women too, and they sit in a room, come up with ideas in a conference or in their own offices, and then they can go right to the director, the head of DARPA, which makes it unusual for a government agency. There's very little bureaucracy. And they can say, hey, I've got this idea for just, for instance, a GPS that can fit in your pocket. and this was in the 80s.
Right.
Very revolutionary idea at the time.
You're right, back in the 80s. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you were GPS you had to wear on your backpack. You know, it's called a man pack.
Right.
And so they go to the head of DARPA, and they say, I've got this idea. What do you think? And in many cases, he'll just say, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. And he'll fund it. So the internet started out that way, too.
Well, and we'll go back to that because I think that's a story that needs to be told in greater detail, and we will. And there are also, as you said, then there are some projects which you can't write about in the Department of Mad Scientists, which may be where the real, true mad science is going on. I mean, there are some rumors about things. I mentioned I was reading about a project, and I think I included it on the air a couple of months ago about taking microchips from and growing moths around the microchips. This was a way of trying to find out whether you could do that as opposed to implanting a microchip in a moth. And then there was also just, you know, attempts to try to come up with a mechanical moth to do like a little, to engineer a little teeny moth. So they were trying to, you know, they were working on this from three different vantage points, it would seem, to come to the same place, which would be some sort of usable, trainable moth for whatever reason they saw that. And you know that one, that's not a myth. That one's true.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So they'll come up with an idea like that, and then they'll go farm it out. That's the other thing that makes them unique. Besides this turnover rate of 25% among the program managers, the other thing that makes them unique is that they don't have their own labs. So they'll say, okay, let's do this UAV that's actually a moth. And then they'll go out and find some researcher who seems to have some chance of success at doing this, and they'll fund that person or company or whatever it is.
At a university, at a private company, any place where they find that person and they say, would you like some money to keep working on that idea?
Yeah. Some of these folks are new players. You know, they'll say, oh, this has never done before. No one's ever even approached this subject. Let's go find somebody new to do this. Or in some cases, their labs have been working for DARPA for decades.
Let's talk about that process. Here's how I imagine it happening. You're at your lab somewhere in some, you know, Division II university as you toil away at this project that you're heavily emotionally invested in. The head of your department thinks you're crazy, but it gives you just enough to keep going. And then one day, suddenly two people show up in black suits holding a briefcase full of money. Is it at all like that for these DARPA funds?
In some ways, yeah, it is. You know, there's kind of a mystique around DARPA, including for people who work there. Typically, they only serve a term of 4 to 6 years. Everyone's got their expiration date printed on their badge.
Right.
They have to leave. So a lot of these folks come into DARPA because of this mystique. They get the mysterious call that one guy was describing to me, the mysterious call.
What happened to him? Tell which one of your guys you wrote about got the mysterious call?
So that was Colonel Jeffrey Ling.
The Asian American guy with the arm.
He's an Army trauma doc. He served two tours, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq, and he felt this need to create a prosthetic arm that was fully functional, that was basically indistinguishable from what they call a native arm. And it would be brain-controlled. Yeah.
I love that.
And they were really trying. This program is just winding down. It's just wrapping up. He wanted to get this arm up and running within about 4 years. And the idea is you'd be able to go back to active duty if you were a soldier who lost an arm. Or if you didn't want to, you'd go back to civilian life with this arm. Then they funded a competing project. This is typical of DARPA. You mentioned several approaches for these insect UAVs. This is what they do often. They'll fund a wild, way out there project like that, and then they'll go and fund, spread their risk a little, fund something a little less ambitious along the same line. So they created what Ling called the strap-and-go arm.
Right.
So he thought, well, maybe not everyone wants neural implants, or maybe not everyone's comfortable with that, or what he left unsaid was maybe we'll never pull this off.
Right.
And they funded DECA research.
But he got the call. Ling got that call, that mysterious call. How did that right. come about? What did it, was he?
It's typically through someone you know. So typically these folks, You know, my editor at Wired notwithstanding, typically these folks are in some way, at least on the fringes of Pentagon and defense research. They know people who know people.
Right.
And then that person, they'll get a call from someone like that. Hey, you know, I think it'd be good for DARPA. Why don't you come in and talk, you know? Some people really have very little idea, though, what DARPA even is. There's a few people like that as well. This guy named Rick Satava was telling me, he's another Army doctor who created the trauma pod. That's another DARPA project for an autonomous surgical suite that doesn't have any human surgeons in it. It's all robots. But he got the call, and he really didn't know what DARPA was. You know, maybe heard vague rumors like most of the rest of us, or like I was certainly in that position before I started this book, and kind of learn as they go.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, I'll be repeating that a bunch of times tonight because just for the reason you just said, for some people it's kind of a new concept. So I'm going to go back to the, was it Colonel Ling? Is that who is the, right. the doctor? And here he wanted to come up with an arm, as you said, that as opposed to the native arms that we're born with, but this would serve the same amount of function and it would have a low amount of maintenance. So once it was on, it was on, and it would be implanted so that there would be neuroresponders that would go all the way into your brain so that when, just like any other arm, you thought, pick up this mug, and the arm just picked up that mug. But that's easier said than done. It's easier pictured on the big screen than it is actually pulled off in a lab. So this is an interesting DARPA project that I think for a lot of people does sound like mad science.
It's called Revolutionizing Prosthetics, and that's exactly what it actually has already done. They've put more money into this project than any other prosthetic project. So it's about $100 million project. And there's three really big challenges to this, and this is what they call DARPA hard. You know, they want to go for things that no one else is going to be crazy
DARPA
enough to tackle.
I love that. Love that.
Ling calls them maniacs. He said, what maniac would do this or try to do this? Let's go find these maniacs, you know? And so one big problem you mentioned is control. How are you going to get this thing to do what you want just by thinking about it? That's a huge problem. What are you going to put in someone's brain to read those signals? And how are you going to translate those signals? What kind of algorithms, computer processing do you need? Another big one you mentioned was maintenance, power. How are you going to power this portable, basically robot, for hours at a time without having to plug into the wall every couple? You know, your cell phone, you maybe it'll last you a couple hours talk time with all the GPS and everything you got running on it. And this thing has to be always lifting and carrying, writing, whatever you do with it, without plugging in. So that's a huge problem.
And wasn't it in that chapter that you talked about the button they had to have for research in case the prosthetic started to go wrong? And so it's if the prosthetic started to go rogue, they had some sort of like kill button or something. I can't. Was that the chapter that mentioned
that? That was it. Yeah. This is what I love about this research. The maniacs, as Ling calls them, who took this challenge on, were at Johns Hopkins University in a very prestigious research organization working with DARPA from the beginning. They created the satellites that became the precursor to GPS way back in the 60s. And they, at their labs, they were working on this project, bringing in institutions around the world, you know, sort of funneling research in all these fields, control, power, robotics, and integrating them there in their lab. So I went there to visit, and they had their Proto 2, they call it, the Prototype 2. It was attached to a mannequin that was dressed in Army fatigues, and just a really beautiful device. This thing was moving fluidly through solutes, and you know they were getting ready for a demonstration. They wanted to show it, you know, making a swimming motion and eating motion and all these things. But right next to the operator's console, they had a big kill switch, giant red switch. The guy could just smash his hand down on top of it, and this thing started going haywire.
Right.
It seemed perfectly normal to all these folks at the lab, but I was impressed by that, the kill switch.
Just in case the guy starts screaming, Mongo, fire, or something, and the arm starts waving around. Or so the Department of Mad Scientists, it's a great title for this book. And these guys do think of themselves in a way as sort of maniacs, in the sense that we would say crazy enough to try to do something. And they come up with an idea and they try to not put on the sort of scientific filters that would tell them no, and just to see where it takes them. And that's part of the interesting piece about DARPA is they know they're going to fund a lot of projects that will go nowhere. They just hope that nowhere will then tell them about a somewhere else. How does that sound?
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way to put it. And you know, only one person that I interviewed for the book objected to the title, the Department of Mad Scientists. And I thought there'd be more of these people saying, oh, that's an unfair characterization. We're
right.
Mad scientists. None of them blinked an eye except one guy, one of the most out there, actually. Rick Sabava, I mentioned, he developed TraumaPod. He was inspired a lot by Star Trek, actually.
Right.
And science fiction. He took this directive, find science fiction writers pretty much to heart. He actually had science fiction writers come in. He'd fly them out to DARPA headquarters and brainstorm with them.
Oh, that's totally cool. In this case, though, this trauma pod, I almost want to get more to that here, too. These trauma pods, we know that in battle, for example, we've seen the survival rates that go up dramatically when you get a helicopter to somebody. If you can get them off the battlefield and into a surgical mobile unit within 60 minutes, their rate of survival goes up exponentially. So talk about the survival pods and what that would mean, how that would be the next generation of survival rates for these soldiers in battle.
When they talk about the golden hour, if you get hit on the battlefield and you're losing blood, you've got 1 hour to get to a surgical unit, and that's what the helicopter's for. And that really, really did increase survival rates for wounded soldiers. But now they're talking, hey, what if we could get the surgical suite to the soldier? Instead of having to wait, go fly, pick them up, drive, fly them back out, what if we could just do one way, fly the suite to him? So you're only talking about a one-way trip for that unit to reach him. And suddenly the golden hour becomes the golden minute. So the idea is you got this mobile, autonomous surgical suite that would fly on a Black Hawk or a truck, probably a helicopter, though. And they would land, the wounded soldier's comrades would perhaps strip off his body armor and then strap him into this machine, close the door, and the robots inside would get to work doing ultimately automated procedures that would be probably, right now they're working on the top four procedures: the stop bleeding, stop hemorrhaging, tying off broken arteries, that sort of thing. And just operate by scanning. So person strapped down, a scanner would move over top to bottom, head to toe, develop a picture of this person's internal structure and where the damage was, and then robots would get in there and start threading needles in, finding breaks, inserting catheters to plug those leaks. And all the while, the machine is moving, going. Ultimately, they do want to get back to the hospital, but at least to stabilize the person the way.
I think that's interesting. It actually sort of represents what we learned about the French model of emergency medicine after the car crash that eventually killed Princess Diana. Remember that was there. That's how they do it. They have they bring the whole
stabilize them there on the scene. Yeah,
but start doing the surgery there. They bring the doctors. They stabilize them there, and then they move really slowly to the hospitals while they're doing this work while they're going. And I thought, okay, that's so intriguing. And yet, I want to find out more about these pods in just a second, and all of the research that Michael Belfiore's been doing on the Department of Mad Scientists. You'll hear about how DARPA is remaking our world from the internet to artificial limbs. We heard a little bit about the artificial limbs. There's more to that story, too, and also more to our discussion about the history of the internet from DARPA And then some of the big visions for the future coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If you like the future conversation that we're having tonight, you'd like last night's conversation about the demographics of the past, the present, and what it tells us about the future. We had Neil Howe on last night. And if you missed that, go back and catch it on Streamlink. Always compelling to hear about the millennials, this group, this power group that's going to come and change the way in which the country does business. Once they come into power, that is, they have their own way of looking at things. It's not the way baby boomers do, although they respect boomers, according to the statistics. They want to do it differently than Gen Xers. And so Gen Xers were statistically less likely to be involved in the formation of the U.S. They were a lot more detached. But this next group coming up, the millennials, are not. And they are, quite literally and figuratively, our future. And take a look online and sign up for Streamlink and go back and catch that show. We'll talk more about the future, this time from a scientific standpoint. Some of the technology that will be changing our lives. The Department of Mad Scientists, a book about DARPA. First time DARPA's given an inside look like this to an author, and Michael Belfiore returns the conversation about the internet and how that really got started coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Michael Belfiore is the author of The Department of Mad Scientists. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Put a blog up there earlier tonight if you missed the links we were talking about in the first hour. So, Michael, there may be some people who think that the Department of Mad Scientists, or rather, you know, DARPA itself, is going too far and should be stopped. And so they're going to get on the internet tonight and write some emails about this. Which would be ironic, of course, considering the origins of the internet and email. Talk about how DARPA changed the way in which we communicate.
That's a great success story for DARPA, and also I think a model for how innovation can happen. You know, I was talking about DARPA farms out their research projects, and often the genesis of these projects is one person with a vision, an idea. And this is certainly the case with the internet. There was a guy, Bob Taylor, who was in charge of ARPA, it was called then, in charge of its Information Processing Techniques Office, which is still in operation today. And at that time, mid-60s, if you wanted to use a computer, the newest technology was you didn't actually have to fly across the country to use it.
Yeah.
Computers were installed at major research institutions. They filled entire buildings. They were a big deal. But the latest technology was time sharing, and you could actually log into a computer remotely. And that was a big deal. And Bob Taylor had the latest technology, which was these terminals that could log into different computers around the country. But he was, as typical with a DARPA guy, he was dissatisfied with the state of the current technology. He thought, this is ridiculous. Why do I have to go do a separate login procedure at a separate terminal just because I want to use a separate computer? I should just have one terminal that I could log into any computer I want to use. And he thought, you know, let me go pitch that. So he left his office, went over to the head of DARPA and said, hey, I got this idea for a network that would connect these computers. And
Network. I love that.
Right. Yeah. And the guy thought about it. Yeah. And this is, again, I found it's typical of how DARPA works. It's minimal bureaucracy. The head of DARPA thought it sounded good. And he said, okay, let me just take $1 million from this program and give it to your program. You're going to have a new program now. It's called ARPANET.
Right.
So he went back to his office, and this guy, even Bob Taylor, was kind of blown away with how quickly that whole thing went down.
He
figured about 20 minutes.
Yeah. And the ARPANET was born.
That's right. And so, again, typical of DARPA, they farmed out the work. So they farmed it out to UCLA and Stanford and a place called BBN in Boston. They had to come up with basically everything we take for granted today in computing. There's no such thing as a standard operating system. Every computer was basically purpose-built. They might be built along similar lines, but, you know, it might be a similar model, but each computer was essentially unique, and each group of people who used it had to learn unique codes and ways of interacting with it. So this was the first time somebody said, let's standardize all this. Let's create an information protocol that would allow computers of different types to all interface with each other. And they created these things called IMPs, Interface Message Processors, which today we'd know as a router.
Right.
You know, this thing you plug into your, exactly, your internet connection, your, right, you know, DSL or cable or whatever it is.
But an IMP. I love that.
IMP. It's called the IMP. BBN created these things. They were the size of refrigerators. They were enormous. They shipped them across the country to UCLA and Stanford, and some guys at UCLA connected it to their big computer at UCLA. And, man, this thing was so big, they couldn't get it through the door. They had to, you know, crank it in through a window or something.
Right.
And they connected that. So 1969, way back then, the guy in charge of the project at UCLA, Leonard Kleinrock, a DARPA researcher and a professor at UCLA, he likes to point out, hey, 1969, big year, right? We had Woodstock, and we had Man on the Moon. Mets won the World Series. Charles Manson was killing people in Los Angeles.
Right.
But nobody noticed what may have been the biggest story of the year, which was the creation of the internet. And the first time that two computers of different types actually reached out and talk to one another. And of course, this was somewhat less spectacular than Neil Armstrong's,
right,
walk on the moon. The UCLA computer connected, and this is all over phone lines now, so less than stable connection to begin with. But these two computers each connected to their own IMPs, which,
right,
acted as the go-between, one at UCLA, one at SRI, Stanford. They connected for just two characters worth of information. The guy at UCLA, his name was Charlie Klein, who was actually sitting at the terminal. He typed in L, you know, and he's talking to on the phone to the guy over at Stanford. He's like, "Did you get the L?" You
know? L. I'm sending you an L.
Yeah, I see it. Yeah, got the L. And he types the O. And he goes, "Did you get the O?" Yeah, got the O. And his intention was to type log in. Or,
right,
log on. He was going to log on to that remote computer. But the other machine crashed after it got the O. So he typed L-O.
So L-O?
Yeah, or low, as Kleinrock likes to say.
Right.
Low, as in lo and behold.
Lo and behold. You know, it's funny, you know, you say, and I understand that there really is no difference now between ARPA and DARPA, but there was a moment or two, wasn't it, at the beginning before the Defense Department really took over DARPA? Wasn't there a period of time when ARPA might have gone in a different direction? I mean, we're talking about the creation right after Sputnik, and I think that story might need to be told a little bit about the creation of this, what we know today now is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. But at the time, it was sort of almost a knee-jerk response to Sputnik having been successfully launched by the Soviets.
It was 1957, October 4. That was a date that people at the Defense Department elsewhere in the Eisenhower administration just, like, you know, that was like almost like their Pearl Harbor. It was, the Soviets had developed the means by which to send nuclear weapons around the world. That's really what Sputnik represented. Never mind the fact that Sputnik was tiny. You know, the technology to create a nuclear weapon that small just didn't exist. But the fear was there. Now the Soviets have the high ground. And a lot of folks in the military thought, well, this is really bad news. And any place humans have gone, whether it be sea or air, underwater, they've always brought conflict with them. And the Soviets have the only technology for getting to that high ground of space. We're really in trouble. And Eisenhower himself really didn't see it that way, but his advisors did. And they said, we've really got to do something, and we got to do something public, and we got to do something fast. So ultimately, Eisenhower had in mind to create a civilian space agency. That's where he was going. He wanted space to be at least ostensibly a civilian domain. And ultimately that resulted in the creation of NASA. But that was going to be, as it is now, a huge undertaking, big bureaucracy, lots of laboratories, many, many people working there. What they needed was something quick, something they could just pull together quickly, get, you know, find the smartest people they could, put them in a room, come up with ideas to not only regain the high ground in space, or not regain, gain it, and but also to prevent technological surprise for the future. What other technologies besides space might the Soviets or another adversary get first that we should know about first? So that's how ARPA got created, and it was directly through the efforts of McElroy, head of the Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense under Eisenhower. He wanted to create what he called a special projects agency. And the armed services did not like this at all. They didn't like the idea that some semi-autonomous agency was going to perhaps claim dominion over projects that they should get.
Right.
But the idea was to cut through the bureaucracy. The services had their own space projects going, but they were all in competition. There was the Navy, there was Air Force, Army. They all had their own space projects. One of which actually was capable of reaching orbit before Sputnik. It just wasn't allowed to do it.
Was that the Navy project?
Yeah, that was actually an Army project.
That was the Army project. Because they had competing projects. The Army rockets and the Navy rockets were competing.
Yeah.
And they said, I mean, right after Sputnik, wasn't the claim was made, you know, hey, we could have been up there a year ago. So not only then do they have to live with the fact that Sputnik is floating overhead, but they had the technology, they just didn't have the green light.
This is a fascinating scene. I just loved uncovering this bit of history that most of us don't know about. On October 4, 1957, the day Sputnik was launched, McElroy, he was about to be sworn in as the Secretary of Defense, and he was touring the different installations around the country. He was actually visiting the rocket shop run by Wernher von Braun, who, of course, later led the team building the moon rockets. He was working for the Army in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, it was called then. And he was being wined and dined by the general who's running the place, General Medaris. And Medaris was really angry because his team had the technology to reach orbit. And the year before, they had actually launched a rocket that was capable of getting to orbit. All they had to do was put fuel in the upper stage instead of sand, which is what they were required to do, and that thing would have gotten to orbit. And we might not be having this conversation now. ARPA might not have been created. NASA might not have been created. We would most likely live in a different world today. But Eisenhower, again, wanted the space project to be civilian. So he said, you guys, cool it. You know, we want the first satellite up there to be a civilian one. So when you launch that rocket, don't put it in orbit.
You know, that's interesting to me as I was reading that part of the story, because I think I look at it through today's lens. And if that had been President Obama who had made that decision, there would have been a great amount of criticism for him being a civilian making that decision and then, you know, not getting the military and or working against the interests of the United States or, you know, whatever the accusation would have been from the critics of the president. And yet it was Eisenhower, general, military man, very focused on keeping space, or at least, as you say, ostensibly, to keep the space program a civilian one and to keep the perception that we're not turning space into another battlefield. And I thought that's interesting that it would take, you know, it sort of takes Nixon to go to China. It took Eisenhower to put the emphasis on keeping that type of exploration, scientific exploration, civilian.
Very interesting. Yeah. And that's partly where I think ARPA comes in as an agency, not just for the military, but one that's had tremendous value through the civilian world as well. Eisenhower, of course, created the interstate highway system with
right.
defense money. So really interesting contradictions or whatever, however you want to look at them there. So,
ARPA, well, he's a very practical guy, and I think you make the point effectively when you say he turns out to be right. I mean, if Eisenhower had, you know, as frustrating as it might have been for those guys, and I could totally get their, I could feel their pain of, we could have done this, that could have been our moment. In a way, we may never have had NASA, we might never have had
the success of landing on the moon. We might have had all sorts of other, you know, sort of geopolitical problems if we had militarized space, so to speak, up front. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think Eisenhower deserves to at least be credited with being somewhat forward thinking on that possibility.
For sure. And that's a debate that goes on today. Should we militarize or weaponize space? There are people saying that's inevitable.
Right.
Wherever we go, we bring conflict with us. This is what Madaris said, who led the team that Von Braun was running to create rockets. And ARPA, in fact, took over or contracted out to those folks for their first project. So ARPA was created as America's first space agency. You can go back and look at headlines, New York Times, saying, you know, new space agency created. It was not NASA. It was ARPA.
And when did ARPA become DARPA?
ARPA became DARPA just, you know, it's really just a name as far as I could figure. It didn't really change their purview or the way they did business or anything else. They just put a D for defense, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And then that went away again in the 90s. There was an idea thinking was, well, ARPA or DARPA has been very beneficial, perhaps inadvertently, perhaps not, for civilian application as well as military. Why don't we just sort of formalize that and give ARPA or DARPA a mission to be dual purpose? So it's part of the Department of Defense, always has been. But now let's give it a specific mission that it's going to deliberately try to create a dual function,
as
the internet had for both military and civilian use. So the D went away in the 90s, and then that was only very briefly, though. The whole Department of Defense had a crisis of confidence after the fall of the Soviet Union. It's been in the news, you know, lately, the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the Department of Defense is, the whole thing, including ARPA, scratching their heads, going, "Well, now what do we do?"
Well, now we lost our focal point.
So they thought, you know, let's make it dual purpose. And people I've talked to didn't really feel that worked out. It's like ARPA and DARPA have always functioned best as a very clearly focused military mission that then has spinoff application.
Right. Well, let's go on the ARPA net and talk about it. So then back to DARPA, and that's where we are today. And that's why every so once in a while that vocabulary gets confused. But the Department of Mad Scientists is the book by Michael Belfiore, and he gets into some of these stories, these never before told stories about the creation of DARPA and how it's remaking our world. We've talked about the internet. We've talked about artificial limbs. Coming up, I want to get into, I want you to sort of cast, as DARPA itself is very forward thinking. And I know you weren't allowed to look in all of the X-Files that they have going on over at DARPA. But I would love for you to speculate, based on what you've been exposed to and what you've written about, what you think our world will look like in 5 to 10 years if there are a reasonable number of these DARPA projects achieve some sort of payoff. Okay. So I want to save that coming up for next hour. But I want you to, if you could, focus on that, because I think that's where, you know, as you said, back in 1969, we never would have known that the internet had been created. We never would have known. And the four people that were there that were part of it, they couldn't even have probably imagined where we are today with this. So maybe as we look, you know, into the next 5 to 10 years, I'd be curious to see what are the ARPANET projects that are going on right now, that are going on online, so to speak, that will change the way we live and breathe in the future? And I'd love to explore that. Let me just ask you another quick question before we get to the top of the hour, though. What's been the response to the book from former DARPA scientists or the ones that are in there now? Are they excited about this new publicity?
Yeah, they are. People want the recognition. There's always a tension between that and, well, a lot of what we do is secret.
Right.
But they also have a need to get the word out, to get researchers working on projects and interested in becoming program managers at DARPA. So the feedback's been positive.
So very likely in the future, when those two people show up from DARPA in black suits with a suitcase of money and say, "Hey, would you like to do a project?" They'll hand somebody a big wad of cash and a copy of your book, just in case they don't know about the Department of Mad Scientists, Michael Belfiore, on what our future will look like coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.